This is the SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and today I have an interview I did while on faculty at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference in Colorado Springs, Colorado. PPWC is held every year in April and is a great conference for writers of all levels. Each year, the folks at PPWC bring the best of the best as keynote speakers, and this year was heavy with genre authors such as Jim C. Hines, Chuck Wendig, Gail Carriger, and my guest today, Carol Berg. A former software engineer, Carol Berg's 14 epic fantasy novels have won national and international awards, including the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and multiple Colorado Book Awards. They've been read, so readers tell her, on 5 different continents, on a submarine under the Mediterranean in the war zone of Iraq, and on the slopes of Denali. Starred Reviews and Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Reviews called her novels of the Collegia Magica things like compelling, intelligent, complex, and superbly realized. Next up is a new fantasy mystery duology about a sorcerer who draws portraits of the dead. First volume, Dust and Light, comes out from NAL Rock Books in August of 2014. Carol camps, hikes, and bikes in Colorado and lives on the internet at www.carolberg.com. She can also be seen at Mile High Con in October, so I suggest you come say hello and buy her a beer. To learn more about the Pikes Peak Writers Conference, please visit pikespeakwriters.com. And now, here's Patrick and Carol. I'm sitting here at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference 2014 in Colorado Springs with Carol Berg. And Carol writes epic fantasy.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do. And we met actually at Mile High Con a couple years ago. You were kind enough to sit in on a panel. And we had some fun there. And so when they harassed you about being interviewed again, you reluctantly said yes.
I have a book coming out. I don't refuse interviews. So, you know, with author sluts, that's what we are, right?
So how many books are in the series right now?
The book that comes out in August is the first.
In a new series?
2-book series.
Okay, but yes. The other series that they got downstairs in the bookstore?
I have 5 different series so far.
Really?
This will be a 6th, yes.
Holy crap, Carol.
Yeah, I don't go on forever. Mine stop.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, they do. They do. I have one standalone. Mm-hmm. I have 1 2-book series, and now this new one is a 2-book series.
Okay.
I have 2 3-book series and a 4-book series, and that's as long as it's ever going to get.
So when people pick up a Carol Berg book, they know there's an end in sight.
They know there is an end in sight, yes.
That's great. Yeah. Not a lot of people are doing that. Do you ever get, I'm just curious, do you ever get pressure from like publishers going, hey, what do you think about making this a 7-book series?
No, I don't. No, because mine are not episodic series. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at Harry Dresden, Jim mm-hmm. Butcher's books are...
Yes, I love those.
I do, too. I love them. And they're an episodic series, and yet he has this growing, overarching story as well. Most 15-book series don't do that. Most of them, you know, if you look at, Philip Marlowe, or you look at, Tony Hillerman, people like that, you know, names escape me when I'm talking about them.
That's fine.
But you look at things like that, and detective series.
Sure.
Classic detective series, or the classic cozy mystery series. Mm-hmm. Those can go on forever because they'll have threads that are in the background that continue, but the story is really the story of each episode, whereas my books... The big story is the story of spans 3 books, and there are endings at the end, endings at the end mm-hmm. of each book.
Convenient.
Yeah, I like it that way.
Yeah.
It's my mathematical background. I like to do that. But each book has an ending, but it's very clearly within the context of a larger story, and my larger stories don't go on forever.
Okay. So if someone listening to this right now wanted to go out and get the Carol Berg experience, they want to read the book that's going to make them love what you write and pick up all the other books, where should they start? I wish the listeners could see the look on your face right now. You're like, wow, what a question.
Oh yeah, what a question, because it depends.
Okay.
It depends on what kind of books they've read before and liked. many people think my very first book is the one that drew, they say that's the one that drew them in, but was it because they were, that was the only one available there? I don't know. Some people like one series better than the other. I try not to make them all alike. Mm-hmm. But I'd say if you, you know, if you like traditional fantasy at all, the Reich, books of the Reich Era, Transformation, Revelation, Restoration, mm-hmm. are a way to go. If you like something, my sort of crossover mystery and late Renaissance, early Age of Reason series, if you like the world of Newton and Galileo and Kepler and with a murder mystery with I call it my secret agent double, you know, no, murder mystery double agent set in the time of Newton and Galileo, you know, something like that. But that's the novels of the Collegia Magica that I just finished with three books.
Okay.
Starts with The Spirit Lens, then The Soul Mirror, and The Demon Prison. You know, that might be the way to go. If you're a mystery reader, if you like murder mysteries and maybe can stand a bit of fantasy, you can get in there.
You talked about your math background.
Yes.
What is that?
My first college degree is in math.
How many do you have? 6, 7?
No.
8 degrees?
No, just 2. Mathematics and computer science, mm-hmm. that came later. I was a working software engineer for many years, and I took up writing as a hobby.
Okay, interesting.
never expecting that I could ever even write a book that anybody would be interested in reading.
And you outline, don't you?
No, I do not.
You don't?
No, that's why I never thought I could write a book. Because I heard an interview with P.D. James, mm-hmm. many, many years ago, and she was explaining her process, and her process is she's a meticulous outliner because her books are immense and very complex psychological mystery, and she said that, you know, she spends 2 years outlining a book.
Wow.
And she gets it all on note cards, and she rearranges them, every scene, every character detail, every revelation, every clue, everything. She has a note card. I said, no wonder I've never been able to even think about writing. You have to know all that stuff, and you have to plan it out. I could never do that.
Interesting.
And so I firmly believe that I never could, though I read all my life and loved all kinds of books, but... Yeah. So thank goodness you don't have to do that.
Does the math ever come into these stories?
Well, what I say is more, people usually ask, they don't ask me about the math because I don't put differential equations in my theory, logic.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, if you started putting equations in the books, then the printer, the publisher would have to get that font.
There'd
be all this extra stuff, all this extra work.
Yeah. It would just be terrible. No. It's more, my software engineering background comes into play in my writing because I believe, you know, I set out premises, you know, for my magic, for my world, whatever. Developed over the course of writing it, of course, but I believe that you can make anything happen in a story as long as you start with premises and connect them with logic in language. You can mm-hmm. make anything happen. You can make your characters do anything. I say it, you know, one of the worst things a writer can do is to take a character and force that character into a predetermined plot without considering why, you know, all the alternatives or why people would do these
sure.
things or without saying, well, if he just looked over his shoulder, there would have been no mystery because he would have seen who killed the other person. But I do believe you can make characters do what you want. And that's just what you do in software engineering is you want to make something happen. You figure out what you've got to work with and then you plot a course that, you know, to where you can make what you want happen.
Well, I'm glad you explained that because I was trying to figure out how software fit into fantasy.
It's not because good software is fantasy. No. No, but that's, so it's that logical underpinning to your story.
Sure.
Which I think makes a huge difference.
So when you're writing your story, do you do a lot of comments? Pound, 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 comment, pound, pound, pound,
no,
comment.
I'm talking about
software. Come on.
No. Oh, yeah, that. See, I'm getting farther and farther away. I document some decisions that I make in case I need to go back and figure out why the heck did I write that way. But I do that. I mean, I certainly keep notes alongside. So, yes, I suppose in a way I do, but not embedded in the story itself. It's very contrary to my...
Do you do versioning?
No.
No.
Okay. No, I don't. If I make some major change along the way where I feel I'm looking back and I say, oh, I really think this section needs a different opening or something, I may copy that over somewhere and say, that's the old opening of part three. And then experiment. But generally, I keep everything in one file. I write from beginning to end. And
so you're linear. You write from beginning to end.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Don't
jump because the way I develop the story, I don't feel I can't write a scene without knowing whether the hero slept last night, whether the weather's gotten colder, whether somebody's gotten sick or wounded or whatever. I can't move forward. I have to know the circumstances. I have to know where I am, where I've been, and then where I'm going. So, yeah, I write beginning to end. And I'll always have an idea of where I'm going, of course, even from the first scene. Even if I don't know exactly how this story is going to end, I may have some vague idea about it. But I have an idea of, okay, where I need to go in this scene. You know, do we, you know, if we open with the prince buying the slave in the slave market, then I know that the first scene, we've got to get him bought. We've got to get him back to the place where he's going to be living. And so I can write from there.
So you mentioned a new book out. What book is out
right
now?
Yes, this is the, it's called Dust and Light.
Okay.
And it's the first of two books called The Novels of Sanctuary or The Sanctuary Duet. It's actually the first time I've gone back to the world of one of my other series. And the other series was The Lighthouse Duet, which was Flesh and Spirit and Breath and Bone. That's the duology that won the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award.
Wow, very cool.
Number of years ago. And I love the background of that story, this world on the brink of an environmental disaster, this very prosperous and gracious kingdom that all of a sudden is facing a winter that doesn't seem to want to end, plus facing the loss of a great king and a civil war ensuing. And you've got packs of fanatics running around saying, oh, all this is because we offended the gods. What we need to do is essentially eliminate civilization and sort of all go back to living in caves to appease the powers that are destroying the world. And against this background, I have this fairly stratified society where magic is confined to certain families, and they contract their members out to whoever can afford them. And I really like the idea of this contractual magic that this sorcerer might be contracted to a town or to a noble or to a market fair or someone else, whoever can afford him, and which is because they're very expensive, and that they're sort of above politics, above loyalties, except to their own kind, because magic is a divine gift. And your duty as a family of sorcerers is to preserve that gift, to enrich that gift, and to provide it to the world by your members. And you only have, and each person born into this life, they have a choice of their mother's bloodline magic or their father's bloodline magic. And Of course, the first series was about a young man who rebelled against that. He said, "This is nothing but slavery with golden chains." That's the Lighthouse duet.
Interesting. Okay.
And I decided that I really wanted to explore it more because I really liked this whole structure of contractual magic and these families that have kept themselves apart. That's part of who they are, is that they promote detachment from the world, detachment from ordinaries. They do their jobs, they devote themselves to the service of whoever buys their contract, but their loyalty is truly to their families and to the gods who've given them this gift. And I decided, well, what if there was someone who was sort of this polar opposite, who believed in this discipline, in this structure, and this life of study and detachment, and they were not encouraged to have friends. Their family, you know, got their loyalty. They were always very wealthy, very aristocratic, very well educated. And so I had someone who believed in this. And of course, bad things happened to them too.
Sure.
So, but that's one reason I wanted to go back to the world, because in viewing this whole thing, this world structure through the eyes of a renegade, is very different from viewing it through someone who believes in it and
right.
who believes in the way the whole administration, the way these
families like
are administered.
Yeah,
yeah, he liked
it.
It was structure that he believed in, but he has trouble.
Well, what I like is when I ask a question and the author answers it, and in my head I'm thinking of the next question, and the author answers that as well, because that was going to be my next question: what made you decide to go back? Because you've kind of made it clear that that's not something that you normally do.
No, it's not. And I thought, well, and you know, that might make it easier. No. No,
there have been authors who create a world and they keep going back, but from different point of views. And it
right.
sounds like that's what you're doing.
Right. That's what I'm doing. And, you know, I always said, you know, I was never going to go back just because this series was more successful than this one, or, you know, that I just wanted to, you know, keep revisiting that mm-hmm. world, and that I would never go back without a reason. And the reason that I decided was that I didn't feel like I'd explored this aspect of the world very much
So basically, you built a world that you really like. It's very rich.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of detail to it. There's a lot of stuff going on.
Right.
And you said, well, last time I looked from it from this point of view over here on the left, and now I'm going to look at it from this one over here and just
exactly.
you know, kind of play with it.
And what I like to think, my plan is, so this series starts about 2 years earlier than the events of the other one. There's a span of a 3-year civil war between the time the king actually dies and the matter is settled at the end of Breath and Bone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I set this one to begin rather than in the last year of the war. Those two books began in the last year of war. This one begins early in the war and should end right about the same place. But I'm not going to give away. People should be able to read either pair first.
Okay.
And without spoilers. That is really tricky. it's harder than I thought. Plus, I have an intervening series, and I have to keep checking myself. I have to go back and say, now, what did they call that? You know, what did they...
Continuity.
Yeah, continuity. And I didn't... I kept good notes, but not about everything, of course, that I want to know now. I kept good notes on what I used then, but I didn't keep good notes on everything.
So I'm curious, because we are at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference, you're on faculty,
yes.
so that means that you actually did a workshop, or you're
yes.
doing a couple. Or,
yes.
What are your workshops? I mean, what are you teaching the newbie authors that are here trying to learn?
The first one I did, I just finished actually about a half hour ago, and it was on communicating character. I've done a number
okay.
of workshops on character development, because I love rich characters. I love characters that have nuances to them, that are truly individuals and believable individuals, that they're not all perfect, they're not all bad, that villains that you think could have gone another way if just the right thing had happened, or if they weren't missing some fundamental piece of their moral structure or something like that. And, you know, heroes that make mistakes and, you know, heroines that get mad and they're not sweetness and light. So I really have worked hard at character development. And so I did this one about essentially how to write a character, the ways you can introduce a character, the ways you can develop them on the page, sort of like you're getting to know a person. And that's in that the first time you see them, you don't describe their hair color, their eye color from, you know, from 500 yards away. Oh, he's blue eyes and blonde hair and other ways that you can do those things.
The other one I've heard is that don't use mirrors.
Yes, that's one
don't
of my...
Don't have someone looking in a mirror.
And a pond.
Pond.
No, no ponds either, and no rivers and no lakes.
What about a shiny surface in an elevator?
No spoons, no forks, no. No, there are other ways. There are other ways. And so that's one of the workshops. And then tomorrow I'm doing a workshop on called Writing the Eye, and that's... I as in spelled I, not I-E-Y-E.
Sure.
So about writing first person.
Okay.
Because I was really surprised, actually every one of my novels is written in first person, and I was really surprised when people started saying, you know, I really liked your books, even though they are in first person. I just never understood that there were a lot of people out there who really dislike it.
Interesting.
And so I now take it as a great compliment when somebody says, I really like your books, even though it's in first person. Because I look at many of the favorite books on my shelf and they're first person books. And so I tried to figure out what it was that people didn't like about it.
It's interesting because you mentioned Jim Butcher, and that is one of my favorite series, and it's all first person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like that. And you look back at, you know, Zelazny and the Amber books; they're first person.
It's hard today to find first person in certain genres. Urban fantasy, I think, is pretty drowned in it at this point. Everybody's doing it, but epic fantasy is not, for example.
Yeah, and I think that's too bad because I think it's hard. It's hard when you have adventures that span, you know, great spaces of time and space and so forth. But what I say is I write epic fantasy through a very personal viewpoint and great events through the eyes of an individual. I have used multiple narrators in some books. This particular one that I'm writing, it will be these both books will be from the same person's point of view. And the Rykira books are all from one point of view. But my Bridge of Darkness series, one book is from a single point of view, and the others are from multiple first person narrators, because I did have events that one person couldn't witness both events.
That's always tricky.
Yeah.
Especially in first person.
Yeah, it is. And so you can have, you know, but you can have a multiple first person narrator. You just keep it straight. You keep the reader straight on who's talking. And I tend to do it in clumps of chapters. Mm-hmm. I don't alternate within a chapter, and I don't switch back and forth one chapter to another. I think giving the reader a little continuity with a narrator is important, but you know, there are techniques to do it. But so I've done that with the Darneth books are probably my most spread in space and not in space.
I understand.
Opera, but distance.
Yes, distance. I got that. I'm curious when Carol sits down and she wants to read something. Mm-hmm. Just to relax, kick back. You know, you've done your writing for the day. It's time for you to read. What do you pick up and read?
I tend not to read a lot of epic fantasy when I'm writing fantasy. I just don't. I read some urban fantasy, tends to be by my friends that I've met. I like to read mysteries. I always read Jim Butcher's books when they come out.
I do too.
That's the one that I pick up right when it's out. I will say, you know, Jim's first book and my first book came out within a year of each other, and we had the same publisher. And I actually met him back at the Philadelphia Worldcon, and I hadn't heard of him, but I went and picked up his first book, and I said, "Oh my God, I wish I'd invented Harry."
Harry's in a lot of trouble.
He is.
I'm worried about Harry, and I'm worried about Molly.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Worried about and this is spoilers. So if you don't want to hear this, you need to fast forward 2 minutes. I'm worried that Molly has all of the hair clippings, nails, and blood that Harry asked her to destroy in the last book. And I don't think she destroyed it.
I think Molly is, I think she's severely compromised.
Yes. And of course,
I think that's too bad because she's an awesome character and their relationship is awesome.
Yes.
I was like, I went to MissCon, wonderful little convention in Missoula, Montana, last year when Jim was guest of honor.
I got to interview him and I totally fanboyed.
Yeah.
I totally fanboyed.
Yeah, we all do. But he takes it. He's cool about it.
He is. He was very nice.
So
what's you've got that book coming out. What's next for Carol? What is on the horizon?
You know, I don't know. One thing I did 2 weeks ago is I wrote a short story.
Okay.
That was really scary because I've written one short story in my life, and I gave that one away.
Interesting, okay.
And this one is supposed to come out from in an anthology from Ragnarok Publications, Joe Martin's thing in the summer. And in it, I have my hero from Flesh and Spirit and Breath and Bone. It's a sort of a prequel story, meets one of the principal characters in the new book before the events of either book, and I thought it was quite fun to do, and that was kind of scary because I've always said that I just don't write short. When I think short, I think 150,000 words instead of 175. But I've also written a couple of novellas, and I really liked that because you could really tell a complex story in a novella.
Mm-hmm. And problem is there's not a lot of markets for novellas.
Well, I understand it. But see, that's where I think self-publication
is good, yes.
Is really excellent because I think, I could perhaps put some novellas. The novellas that I've written are both associated with books that I've written. And so I think that's kind of a fun thing for readers. And so I might explore a little bit of that. As for bigger projects, I'm not sure. There is one that I'm thinking might happen, but I have no idea. It is at the end of these. So these two duologies will end pretty much at the same day, actually. And I'm thinking, oh, and then what if? If these two sort of opposite kind of guys, the renegade and
they meet?
The well-disciplined person.
Hey,
the kingdom is, it's in...
I got an idea.
Taiwan. Yeah?
80s buddy cop movie.
Oh. You just never know. But, there's always ideas.
Tango and Cash?
there's always ideas rolling around in there. So I really don't know. I mean, I will say I am and I always have been a serial processor. I am not a parallel processor.
Okay.
I think one story at a time. That's why it just about gave me the heebie-jeebies to write a short story in the middle of writing the next book. But it came out, I think it came out all right.
It's funny you talk about writing short stories. I decided to write a short story. I decided I was going to work on and writing short stories. This was years ago. And so I sat down and I was going to write a short story. And 11,000 words later, I was done. And I showed it to Karen Burnham, who is a contributor at SF Signal. And she said, now just make it 3,000 words. There's no way. There is no way to make this 3,000 words.
Yeah. I don't have that magic. I do believe writing short story is art form. It's an art form. It's not quite as hard as writing picture books or poetry, but it's right in there with those things.
Haikus.
Yeah. those things without a lot of words. And I mean, I trim out, you know, when I finish a manuscript, when I turn in a manuscript, after I turn in a manuscript, I rip out enough words to make, you know, 5 short stories and, or, you know, 2 novellas or whatever. You know, it's not uncommon for me to, you know, take out that much and throw it out. And so, so keeping it limited is a true,
yes,
a well, true effort.
Carol, I hate to say it, but we're actually out of time. So what I'd love for you to do is tell our listeners where they can find you online, what your website is, where they can go and find your books, all that good stuff.
Okay. My website is www.carolberg.com. Carol with no E. I would be cooler if I had an E on my Carol. Though I have people who say it would be better if I was Carol R.R. Berg. That would be much better. But it's just carolberg.com. And I'm also active on Facebook and under Carol Berg. Just Facebook/
Very cool.
Carol Berg.
And any other appearances this year you want to tell people about? Any place you're going to be?
I'm probably going to be at BuboniCon.
Okay.
In the 1st of August down in Albuquerque. I'm going to be at World Fantasy in Washington, D.C.
Nice.
In November, I'll be at Mile High Con. Mile High Con every year.
Nice.
In October, and I'll
Did you get your email from Rose already?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so
oh, yeah. Rose is the most awesome of...
Yes.
My, of conference programmers that I know of. She is truly awesome. and then I will be at the Colorado Gold Writers Conference in Denver in September. So
Very
far,
cool.
That's it.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
I want to thank Carol Berg for spending some time with me. Thanks to all the folks at the Pike Speaks Writers Conference who put on such a great event. I really appreciated all of the help and the nice quiet rooms they gave me to record in. That rocked. Sorry about the Kool-Aid stain, MB, and all the bleach, and having to move the couch, you know, to cover up the stain. Hey, some things are simply out of my control. There's more from PPWC coming down the pike. Ha! See what I did there? Pike. Pikes, Peaks, Riders. I slay me. We'll see you next time. Bye. Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day. From weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.